Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Over 50,000 Rohingya Muslims have been forced to flee a violent military crackdown in Myanmar for Bangladesh. At least 86 people have been killed. In an open letter, 11 Nobel Peace Prize winners called the crackdown ethnic cleansing and are calling on the UN to end the human crisis. Myanmar's government has denied reports of abuse and killings, saying it was conducting counterterrorism operations in the region. Aung San Suu Kyi, the Nobel Prize Peace winner who won her historic election last year, is being criticized for failing to stop the violence. Joining us to discuss coverage is Paul Mooney, an award-winning freelance journalist and author who has reported from Myanmar, China, Taiwan, and Hong Kong since the 80s. Paul has written for Newsweek, Asia Week, the International Herald Tribune, and other publications. And Paul joins me here in studio. Hi, Paul. Thank you for coming in.
Hi, Rose. Thank you.
Nice to have you. And the confirmation hearings for Donald Trump's appointees begin next week. The hearing for Jeff Sessions, Trump's nominee to be attorney general, is on Tuesday. This week, six people were arrested in Sessions' Mobile, Alabama office. A number of groups are calling for more civil disobedience in the coming days. We are doing a show about Jeff Sessions next Wednesday. Also next Wednesday, there will be five confirmation hearings, five in one day. Rex Tillerson for Secretary of State, Elaine Chao for Transportation Secretary, Mike Pompeo for CIA Director, Betsy DeVos for Education Secretary, and John Kelly for Homeland Security Secretary. On that same day, Donald Trump is expected to give his first press conference since late July. So we've got five major confirmation hearings and a Donald Trump press conference on the same day. So why isn't this getting more media attention? How will the media cover all of this? How will citizens learn about these appointees when the cameras will most likely be on Donald Trump? Will Bunch is an award-winning political journalist and author of three books, most recently The Backlash: Right-Wing Radicals, High-Def Hucksters, and Paranoid Politics in the Age of Obama. Will Bunch is a senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News and author of the popular blog Attitude. Hi, Will. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, it's good to be back. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you, and Happy New Year to both of you. It's our first Friday show of the new year. As we always do on our media roundtables, we start off on a positive note and highlight journalism that stood out, because there's a lot of great journalism out there. It doesn't always get the attention it deserves. So, Paul Mooney, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
I was very interested in an article by David Fahrenholt of the Washington Post, in which he described how he covered Trump over the past year. And it was interesting because he'd uncovered a lot of details about financial misdoings within the Trump Organization, the foundation. But he did it by kind of old-fashioned, you know, pounding the streets journalism. You know, they went through, you know, countless records. But also he used the internet. He had people on Twitter providing him with information, which was kind of a good combination of a way to kind of cover the Trump phenomenon.
And what stood out for you in that piece? I mean, did he write about what it was like to cover Trump, and did he compare it to what we got from other sources or outlets?
No, I guess he just showed how if you put in the time and effort, you could uncover things, you know.
And time and effort.
Yeah, he called, you know, Trump has claimed that he's given a lot of money away from donations, and he found out that Trump hadn't. He called up 325 charities that he thought Trump might have donated to and asked each one of them, and didn't find any that had gotten a donation from Trump.
Wow. Paul, what are your thoughts overall of the Washington Post's coverage of the election now that it's owned by Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos?
I haven't noticed any difference from before, but, you know, I don't look at the Post as close as I do at other sources, so maybe I'm not a good judge of that. But I thought that in the final months of the election, I thought they did a good job of looking at Trump, which a lot of media failed to do.
And what is David's last name?
Fahrenholt.
Fahrenholt. All right. So David Fahrenholt and the piece he wrote about covering Donald Trump. Thank you for that. Paul Mooney is an award-winning freelance journalist. And what about you, Will Bunch? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Yeah, I saw a fascinating article from kind of an offbeat source, which is the not traditional journalism, I guess, but the Vera Center that studies criminal justice issues put out a lengthy article, but it was a piece of journalism, an article they published this week entitled "Why Are There So Many People in Jail in Scranton, PA?" which It happened to be in my home state of Pennsylvania, but it could have been anywhere. But it looked at a Rust Belt type community that, coincidentally, although this wasn't really part of the main part of the story, but it's an area that really flipped for Donald Trump in the election in November, that just has kind of an off the charts incarceration rate, and it looks at certain things. Certainly, you know, more people of color are arrested at a much higher rate than white people in the county is one of the issues. Also, just it's an economically depressed area, and the jail is a moneymaker for the county, and people are being incarcerated over very small crimes. And I think it's important. I mean, I've been very focused on Trump and Trump's election both before November 8th and since then. But you know, the churn of other social issues facing America that frankly probably aren't going to be addressed by the Trump presidency are still going on, and mass incarceration has got to be one of the top ones on that list. And you know, I certainly applaud groups like the Vera Institute and the journalists who are taking deep dives into this problem, because a lot of it needs to be addressed on the state and local level. It doesn't have to come out of the mess that we have in Washington right now. And so I think while we deal with that Washington situation, we also need to keep our eyes on some local issues where people can still make a difference no matter who the president is.
Yeah, it's so true. And we can talk about this later in the show, but what are your thoughts about this? A lot of journalists and a lot of media critics are writing articles about what it's going to take to cover Donald Trump. A lot of this is unprecedented, while also paying attention to real issues and not letting Trump create the news like he's doing with his Twitter account.
Right, to not let him set the agenda. No,
right.
That's exactly right. I mean, one of the best pieces, and you may have read this one, is by Jay Rosen, the New York University journalism professor, who's really kind of a media guru and really one of the best critics we have out there on the media. He just did a lengthy two-part series on journalism in the Trump age. And one suggestion in particular, which I really liked a lot, is, you know, the traditional White House beat, you know, clearly Trump is going to limit useful access to journalists, and he's going to try and control the media through Twitter and through tweeting information rather than giving people access. So, I mean, his advice is, you know, put your interns or people right out of college on the White House beat, because they're mainly going to be covering things like tweets, and the people who are experienced investigative reporters, kind of like we were just saying, have them set the agenda, have them look into the issues that Trump's not tweeting about, but that are more important, that people need to be knowing about. And I think there's a lot that the media needs to do differently in the Trump era, but I would say number one on that list is, you know, we need to be the agenda setters. We need to take a step back and use our wisdom to see what's important and how those things are being addressed or not addressed, and set the agenda, because Trump is obviously going to try and distract the media at every turn.
Paul, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that this may turn out to be good for the media. I think it was a wake-up call for us. People are thinking a lot more about what went wrong and how we should cover Trump this year. And I've noticed that also there's been a kind of a stronger support for the media from certain circles. New York Times subscriptions have gone up. The Washington Post is hiring 15 new reporters. So we're hearing this across the board, that publications now seem to be kind of rethinking how they're going to do things. So I think it might be good for the media. It might change our direction.
Well, since we're talking about coverage of Donald Trump, let's briefly talk about what's happening next week with the confirmation hearings. They begin next week, and on Wednesday, this is kind of amazing, there's going to be 5 confirmation hearings in one day, including Rex Tillerson for Secretary of State and Betsy DeVos for Education Secretary. On that same day, Donald Trump is expected to give his first press conference since late July. So we've got 5 major confirmations hearings on one day. They're all going to start at around 10 o'clock Eastern, and then Donald Trump will give a press conference. I'm guessing that with all the cameras on Donald Trump, we're not going to get much information about these confirmation hearings. I mean, we should do a whole show on each of these people. We are going to talk about Jeff Sessions next Wednesday. Will Bunch, this should be getting more media attention.
Oh, absolutely. And I think the problem is now, you know, a week ahead of this, it's like you're writing a process story, like, and you're complaining about the process of how they're going to be doing this all at the same time. And I think the average reader, unfortunately, kind of tunes those things out, and then they're not going to realize what happened until it's hit them and it's too late. And, you know, I've been thinking about this problem a lot, because I think generally one of the many challenges posed by Trump is his cabinet picks are so untraditional, but untraditional in the sense of, you know, frankly, you know, being either not qualified or just having such thick skeletons in their closet. And if you look back over the years, you know, there have been a number of high-profile cases where the opposition party, including the Democrats, believe it or not, on some occasions, have, you know, risen up to challenge a controversial nominee. Robert Bork, and this was going back 30 years, obviously, but was an example of where the Democrats had a lot of problems with a Republican nominee for the Supreme Court in that case, and were able to, you know, with a lot of effort, mount an effective and ultimately successful opposition to Robert Bork. And you saw that to a lesser extent and not successfully with Clarence Thomas. But it can be done. But I just don't think they can do five at once. And you look at these people. You look at Rex Tillerson, and you know, just what a, you know, just the terrible role that his company ExxonMobil has played in distorting the climate change debate, and you look at his ties to Vladimir Putin. You look at Betsy DeVos, who has absolutely zero experience with public education in this country, other than trying to undermine it to support her agenda of charter schools and religious schools. And you know, you look at somebody like Steve Mnuchin, the nominee to be Secretary of Treasury, who we're learning more and more was just involved in a massive foreclosure scheme in your home state of California. Mm-hmm. And all of these people should be facing serious opposition. But you know, do the Democrats really have the gumption to do it all at once? I just don't see that, and I think the system is going to be overwhelmed, and I think having these hearings all at the same time is only going to pile onto that problem, and then having Trump, as you said, doing the press conference just makes it even more out of control.
Paul, how do you think the media should cover all of this next Wednesday? Well, and Tuesday, because that's when Senator Jeff Sessions' nomination begins, and The Nation is reporting that Senate Democrats will get to call only four witnesses to testify about the nomination of Jeff Sessions as Attorney General. And there have been protests this week. I'm getting most press releases from groups that are opposing Jeff Sessions.
I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. It's going to be difficult if you have, you know, five people being considered. And then also it seems that it's possible that Trump scheduled this press conference for that same day, for what you said, to kind of divert attention away from that and to, you know, and he's been a master of doing things like this.
Hmm. Well, next Wednesday, this is what's happening. And in order to ensure that these appointees don't get through, every single Democrat needs to vote no and three Republicans need to vote no. Any other thoughts on this, Will Bunch, before we move on? In terms of media coverage,
and that's going to be hard to do. I mean, you look at people like Rex Tillerson, and there are actually some Republicans have raised concerns about Tillerson and his ties to Russia. You know, I think John McCain, for example, has said he has implied that it's unlikely that he would vote for Tillerson. And you look at that and you say, wow, you know, the Democrats just need a couple more votes, but the Democrats are famously not good at sticking together, right? You know, you're going to have some blue state Democrats, energy-producing state Democrats, like like Joe Manchin of West Virginia or Heidi Heitkamp from North Dakota, you know, big energy states, coal and oil, and you know, they may break from the pack. So it's going to be hard. You know, I mean, I think Jeff Sessions is definitely going to be the most interesting. Clearly, I think for one thing, he has caused more umbrage from the African American community, which is getting very well organized, and so you'll see a lot. But you know, on one hand, I think the Democrats are going to be so close to stopping many of these nominees, but on the other hand, I think they're going to be so far.
And then also on Monday, there's going to be a day of action. It's a day against denial to oppose Donald Trump's climate-denying cabinet nominees. This is going to take place across the country. So we'll also keep track of that to see if it gets media coverage. And then next Wednesday, we will be talking about the nomination of Jeff Sessions for Attorney General. And that starts on Tuesday. That's a two-day hearing. And then these others start on Wednesday. The other nominees, like Steve Mnuchin, for example, those have not been confirmed yet for dates. But we'll keep our eyes on that. Today, it's our media roundtable, and we're joined by Paul Mooney, an award-winning freelance journalist and author who's reported from Myanmar, China, Taiwan, and Hong Kong, and Will Bunch, an award-winning political journalist, author, and he writes for the Philadelphia Daily News. Let's talk about what's happening in Myanmar, Paul. Over 50,000 Rohingya Muslims have been forced to flee a violent military crackdown in Myanmar for Bangladesh. And if you search for this, there's actually a lot of good reporting, the BBC, The Guardian, The Irish Times, but I'm not really seeing it when you're flipping through newspapers or going online. So can you just give us first, before we dive in, give us a little bit of background about why this violent military crackdown is happening?
The Rohingyas, they're a Muslim minority in northwest Myanmar, and this has been a problem for decades. A lot of Burmese people, kind of Burmans, don't like the Rohingyas because they're Muslims, and the military government and nationalists have spread a kind of a distorted history about the Rohingyas, questioning their legitimacy in Myanmar. Under the citizenship law in 1982, you had to prove that your family came to Myanmar. Because the Rohingyas originally came from Bangladesh, just across the border. But you had to prove that your family had been there since before the British came in 1824. Now, a lot of people don't have those records. Homes have been burned down in that area. So they've been suffering for quite a while. There was an outbreak of violence in 2012 in the area. And I went up there. Well, I guess I got up there. You know, the government basically pulled out all of the aid workers, all of the assistance. These people relied on assistance basically from Doctors Without Borders and the various NGOs that provided food and medical care for them. And I went up there in 2014, and the situation was just incredibly bad. I mean, there were 130,000 people in these camps, where they were living in shacks or cardboard boxes. Up in the villages that I went to, people had no medical care at all. I spoke to one woman whose husband died because he'd cut himself working, and they had to self-medicate, and he died as a result of the infection. And the government just basically kind of denied all of this. So now we have a repeat of this again. Recently, after the violence in October, foreign aid organizations have been pulled out. Journalists aren't allowed to go in. And so nobody really knows the whole true picture of what's going on now.
Why aren't journalists allowed to go in?
I think it's because, you know, there's been a lot of abuses. They say 1,500 houses have been burned down by the military. Army helicopters have opened fire in villages. Women have been raped. Children have been killed. The government doesn't want the world to see this.
So you've got 50,000 people fleeing. Based on what you're reading and the people you're talking to, how many people have been killed?
This time I'm not sure. I think it's been about a dozen. In 2012, 100 people were killed.
And talk a little bit more about why this is happening and the response. In October, President Obama lifted economic sanctions on Myanmar after meeting Aung San Suu Kyi at the White House. And Aung San Suu Kyi, in the last few years, I mean, we see her photo regularly in the United States. She's been hailed as, you know, a sort of a woman that stands for democracy in that part of the world. So where does she stand on this? Has she said anything about this?
No, she's been... In the past, she's been silent about this. She's been reluctant to say anything. She's in a difficult position. She's not the president. She her party won the election. She should have been the president, but the army changed the constitution several years ago so that if you had a foreign relative, you couldn't become president. And her husband was British, and she has two sons from that marriage, one in America, one in the UK. So she was not allowed to run for president. So she named somebody, and she's kind of like the shadow president. But the military controls all the military and all the security. So whatever the military is doing up in this Rakhine state where the Rohingyas are, she has no power over them at all. She can't do anything. But making matters worse, I mean, she does have kind of she has a super strong support among the Burmese people, but she can't do anything kind of, you know, government-wise because she doesn't have the legal ability to do anything.
Can you elaborate on that? If you're saying that women are being raped and villages are being burned and she can't do anything about this?
This is the problem. I mean, she could speak out. She has a kind of a moral kind of requirement to do that. So not only has she remained silent, she started to also call the reports of these atrocities fake, saying that they haven't happened. She's accused the media of making this up. So it's even worse than that, you know. So not only is she not doing anything, she's now tried to cover up things. And these are things she could control because she's actually the foreign minister. But the Ministry of Foreign Affairs is saying this is not true. She controls the information committee. That they're also putting out this word that this isn't happening. So there's a cover-up, and she's responsible for part of the cover-up.
So if this is not getting that much attention here, but Aung San Suu Kyi does get a lot of attention here, why isn't this getting more?
I don't know. You know, she's very popular even, you know, abroad. She's seen as this kind of goddess of democracy. People had a lot of hope for her, and I think people are feeling to see the reality. On the other hand, the Burmese people are very biased against the Rohingyas. They feel that they're going to try to make Burma a Muslim country. There's a lot of distortions that people believe. If Aung San Suu Kyi was to take a stand on this, she would lose tremendous popular support. Hmm. So on the one hand, she can't control the military. On the other hand, it would be political suicide for her to take a strong stand on this.
Will, I know this is not something that you focus on specifically, but we have a lot of conversations on our media roundtables about how foreign bureaus have been cut, about the difficulties of journalists getting to certain countries. But what are your thoughts on this? Since Aung San Suu Kyi is involved in this, why don't you think this issue is getting more attention in the U.S. media?
Well, I think a couple things. One, and I think this is probably the lesser of the two reasons, is that she has such a sterling reputation. I mean, she's admired to the extent, I mean, she's not as well known in this country as she should be, obviously, but to the extent that she's known, she's widely admired. And you may have noticed the media doesn't always handle discordant information. It's kind of hard to turn the battleship around when there's disturbing details about somebody who's been built up for years as an admirable figure. It kind of throws people for a loop, I think. But I think the bigger reason, obviously a lot of media organizations can't afford foreign bureaus. I mean, where I work, the Philadelphia newspapers, because the Daily News is basically, although it's still published separately, it's kind of merged with the Philadelphia Inquirer, so we're kind of the same organization. And the Inquirer, 20 years ago had four or five foreign bureaus in addition to six or seven national bureaus in different cities around the country. Those things just don't exist anymore except for the one or two bigger papers like the New York Times or the Washington Post. And so you do have fewer voices, but doing that, on the other hand, we live in an era of modern technology, the internet. I mean, there's plenty of ways that a newspaper in Philadelphia or San Francisco can get information out of a place like Myanmar. And I don't think the biggest problem is lack of staffing. The biggest problem is, apathy and lack of interest. And I mean, that's a running problem, but It is shocking when you listen to the BBC or read the BBC's website or go to other countries of the world, and people just are so much more attuned to international affairs than people are in this country. And it's just going to take a huge attitudinal shift for us to get to where we need to be on that point.
Yeah, I agree. I think part of the problem is that people aren't reading the news. They're not paying attention. I recently went to a screening in San Francisco of a movie called Hooligan Sparrow, which was about a sex worker advocate who was trying to get justice for a handful of junior high school girls who had been raped by their school teachers and the principal. And she ended up getting...
In the U.S.?
She ended up getting harassed by the police and detained. And at the screening, the director was there, and she talked a bit about the film. And then several people in the audience seemed very kind of well-educated, raised their hands and said, "Oh, I'm shocked. I didn't know that things like this happened in China." And I thought, for over 20 years, I reported on China, and I reported on these types of things. And it made me realize that a lot of people aren't taking the trouble to read about what's going on around the world.
Hmm. What is that documentary?
It's called Hooligan Sparrow.
And it's opening soon, right, in the Bay Area?
It's actually on Netflix right now.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Will, you wanted to jump in?
I just want to add one more point on I think also the part of the issue is the way that we consume news, you know, in this day and age. You know, it's funny, you know, like a lot of people, I'm a digital subscriber to the New York Times, and so that's how I read the Times 90 to 95% of the time. You know, the days where, you know, once on a blue moon when I take a train up to New York City, or, you know, when I visit my parents who are in their 80s and get the newspaper delivered every day, and I read through the print edition of the New York Times, I find myself reading stories that I'm missing on the digitally, including a lot of international stories, like a story out of Myanmar, for example. Mm-hmm. And I think when we consume news on the computer or on our phone digitally, you know, we tend to target very narrow things that we know we're interested in, and we don't get exposed to things that it hadn't occurred to us that we would be interested in until we see them. You know, countries that aren't even on our radar screen, where if all of a sudden you're flipping through, say, a newspaper and you're confronted by this story, you say, wow, I didn't know about that. That's interesting. So I think the way we consume news digitally, I mean, there's been so much conversation in the last year, as there should be, about the role that Facebook plays and our friends with similar interests, and how that filters the news that a lot of people who spend 90% of their time on Facebook and don't go directly to news websites get their news. So I think all of that is making our world smaller, which is unfortunate.
Paul, as someone who has covered and reported from places like China, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Myanmar since the 1980s, what do you think about what Will just said?
I agree. You know, like, I also subscribe to the digital version of the New York Times. I've been doing it for years, but I never look at the page. I get a list of headlines every morning, and that's what I look at. And so if it's not in that list of headlines that the New York Times sends me, I don't look at it.
Well, over the holidays, I read the New York Times every single day, and what Will is saying is exactly right. They do excellent reporting at stories I would have completely missed if I didn't read the paper. Mm-hmm. And I just want to give kudos to Danny Hakim, who does amazing reporting on pesticides. He's had some amazing investigations that unfortunately aren't getting much attention, but you can find those online. Today, it's our Media Roundtable, and Paul Mooney is an award-winning freelance journalist. He's reported from Myanmar, China, Taiwan, and Hong Kong. And we're joined by Will Bunch, an award-winning political journalist. He writes the blog Attitude, and he's a senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News. Coming up after the break, we will talk about media coverage of the Republican plan to repeal Obamacare. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. And you can post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org, or you may tweet us at Your Call Radio. Coming up in a half an hour, it's Inflection Point here on 91.7 KALW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we'll have a conversation about the future of the Democratic Party. In November, the Democrats, in some cases, were pounded. They lost so many seats across the country. So what have they learned from these defeats? What does the party stand for? That's on Monday. And then we are starting a new Book of the Month Club, and we're going to kick it off with No Shortcuts, Organizing for Power in the New Gilded Age by labor activist Jane McAlevey. She will join us on January 24th, so we hope you can grab a copy of her book and join us with your views and your questions on January 24th. And if you have suggestions for another book, or you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email us feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our Media Roundtable. We are joined today by Paul Mooney, an award-winning freelance journalist. He's reported from Myanmar, China, Taiwan, and Hong Kong. We're also joined by Will Bunch, award-winning political journalist. He writes the blog Attitude. He's also a senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News. And now I would like to welcome Trudy Lieberman to the show. Trudy is a longtime health journalist and press critic for the Columbia Journalism Review. Obamacare led the news this week as Republicans vow to keep their promise to repeal it. According to the Health and Human Services Department, up to 30 million people could lose their coverage. So far, there is no alternative. So how are the media covering this? Hi, Trudy. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me back.
Well, it's great to have you back, Trudy. I have a basic question for you first. A lot of the coverage has been about the politics, about the Democrats saying that Trump wants to make America sick again, and then we know the Republican line. But what about the facts of what Obamacare has and hasn't accomplished over the past 8 years?
Well, I think we've seen a little bit of that. One of the strategies that has been employed in this new messaging war that's going on both sides, the Democrats and the Republicans, I should say, is that they're talking a lot about process. Can they do this? Can they do that? And as part of the messaging that the Democrats are using, they're trying to tell a lot of positive stories about people who have been helped, and there have been millions of people who have secured coverage under the Affordable Care Act. And so we've seen some of that, and we've also seen a lot of facts being thrown at us on Twitter and some of the stories that have been written, like there are X number of people who will lose their Medicaid coverage, and we've saved this many dollars, and that sort of thing. So we have seen a little bit. But what we haven't seen, I think, and I hope that in the next week or 2 weeks the conversation will move in this direction, is to what will these changes that are being contemplated really do, and what sorts of compromises are likely to be made, especially by the Democrats, because we know that they don't really have the votes to stop much of this. And so my guess is that there will be some changes that they will agree to, and I think we need to start changing the conversation a bit and also become more mindful of the people who don't like this law very much. And just in the last week, I've gotten a number of emails from people who have talked about how they have to buy insurance now and they don't mind doing that. They want to be covered, but the price is just so high. They're paying as much as $21,000 a year between their out-of-pocket expenses they have to shoulder now and the premiums, and they're saying they can't afford that. So there's also been that side of the story that hasn't really come out yet, and yet that's an issue.
And that's what I was going to ask you, Trudy. We've had you on many times. We do so many shows about Obamacare, and we get slammed with calls from listeners who are so confused, fed up, because they just can't get a person to answer a question. Where are you seeing coverage that gives you the good, the bad, and the ugly? If you're low income or poor, you're getting subsidies and you're getting coverage, which is a great thing. If you have a pre-existing condition, like my mother, for example, that is no longer an issue, even though her premiums are still very, very high. And then friends who make, say, 65 grand a year, 70 grand a year, their monthly premiums are so high and they have really bad coverage. So there's different layers to this, which we've talked about on the show. But where are you seeing coverage that brings in all of those different layers to Obamacare?
Well, in this latest round of coverage, I haven't seen it yet. I keep hearing about this messaging war that's going on and the sloganeering, the new slogans that are coming onto the scene. And it reminds me very much of the messaging war that went on when the law was passed in the first place, where the press really did take a walk and they were really following what people were saying in Congress and what the advocates were saying and opponents were saying, and they never really got to the substance. So people were really blindsided in terms of what the law would do and didn't do. And I think there's a serious danger that that's going to happen again. And to answer your question, I haven't really seen that kind of coverage yet, and I think that I'm going to be urging the media to start doing that, because otherwise we're going to end up with people not understanding anything about what's going on.
Paul, this is getting major coverage for obvious reasons. What are your thoughts on what you've seen and heard so far?
I'm a bit troubled by the fact that we don't see a lot of reporting really kind of examining the issues. At least I don't. You know, I know Trudy specializes in this, so she knows a lot about it. But as a kind of a normal reader of the news, I myself am confused. The Republicans 2 days ago made quite a few attacks on Obamacare, but I don't know if all of them are valid. For example, they talked about rising insurance costs, but I read earlier that in costs were expected to go up. So it wasn't, and it always goes up, you know, so this was nothing new. So I'd like to see more of an examination of the pros and cons of Obamacare, because I'm confused about it. But my wife and my daughter have both used affordable care here in California, and it's been excellent for them. But I know it's different in different places, but my family, it's actually been quite a help.
What about that, Trudy, fact-checking Republican claims?
I think there's been very little fact-checking of any claim, and I think that's but the claims are being made on both sides, and I think that Paul is absolutely right that we really do need to buckle down and talk about this issue that he raises, and the premiums are going up. And they're going up not only because they always go up, but there's an added component in that this year, and that is that the risk pools in the individual insurance companies have been traumatized, so to speak. They've had a lot of people come into the plans with very expensive health conditions, and that has added to the costs, and they have claimed that they have not been able to cover those costs, and so they've raised their premiums. So those are extraordinary things that have happened, and many of us who have followed this very closely predicted that this would happen about the third or the fourth year, and it did happen. And this is what people are really upset about. And so one would expect the other side to say, well, this was going to happen anyway, and kind of downplay it. But I think we can't downplay it. I think we have to be very honest with people, the media does, and explain why it happened and why it might happen again unless other measures are taken. And I think that they owe their readers or listeners at least that kind of an explanation.
Will Bunch, what are your thoughts on how Obamacare is being covered this week? And are you seeing anything in any of your local papers there in Philadelphia that's covering this well?
No, not really. And you know, my feelings are very similar to Paul's feelings in that I'm frustrated, you know, by the coverage. I'm frustrated by a couple things. One, I'm frustrated by the amount of attention it gets, because of all the things I see that are on the radar screen in Washington right now, this just really, you know, no pun intended, trumps everything else that's going on right now. It's the most important thing. And, you know, last night when I got home from work and flipped on the news, it was, you know, Russian hacking. And I want to be clear, because I don't want to, that's an extremely important story as well. Unfortunately, the way that story gets covered in the media a lot of times is very repetitive, because we don't know a lot of the specifics about how this hacking really worked and who was exactly involved. And so when you watch this coverage, it's a lot of the same things being said over and over again. And I have so many questions about this Obamacare situation, you know, as we've been discussing. You know, what is the specifics? Who's being helped now? Who's going to be hurt if Congress takes these actions? And vice versa. Who is getting a raw deal now, and is there any way to help those people? It needs to be focused a lot more on the individuals. And I do think, you know, knowing how journalism works and also knowing how the partisan sides are trying to, you know, lobby and drum up support, I think you are going to hear more personal stories the next couple of weeks. I certainly hope so. And I hope we'll get a more informed debate. I mean, part of the problem for the poor quality of the Obamacare debate is the poor quality of the politics. You know, for years we've been hearing Republicans say they want to repeal Obamacare and replace it, but there's been literally almost no discussion beyond kind of a ridiculous boilerplate about what that replacement is. And Donald Trump was the worst. I mean, to me, one of the most laughable things he ever said on the campaign trail, and there was a lot of competition for that, was when he kept saying, you know, we're going to repeal Obamacare, replace it with something really great. It's like, well, what? You know, so I think some of the problem is with the media, but I think also some of the problem is, you know, with politicians who've been grandstanding on this issue for several years without any serious plan to really address the problem.
Well, he got almost $2 billion worth of free coverage last year. So, Will, why hasn't he been held fully accountable for these statements?
Well, Rose, I think you know the answer to some of that. I mean, he hasn't had a press conference since June or July, July, I believe it was, of last year. The few interviews that he does do are in, settings that are favorable to him. And I honestly cannot remember a time when a journalist, even when there have been forums like, Matt Lauer or whatever, where he's really been pressed on this Obamacare issue and, like, what it is he's going to replace it. I guess he has brought up, let people buy insurance across state lines. And, these are things we've been hearing since the 1990s. And they're just not the guts of what a comprehensive solution to this problem would be. At least now the debate has moved off the presidential stage to some degree and into Congress, and hopefully we'll get some more clarity on what the real options are.
Trudy, have you interviewed any Republicans about what they plan to do?
No, I have not. The mantra is that they have a plan, but nobody has really seen a plan. I think we know some things, though. I think we have an outline, and it's this outline, I think, that really isn't even being discussed very much. We sort of know right at the outset that some things are not going to change. There are very many popular provisions that I don't think are going to change. And a couple of them are the keeping the kids on your policy until they're 26. That's not going to go anywhere. And the consumer protections that do away with the lifetime limits on policies, that's not going to go anywhere either. It's also questionable whether the pre-existing conditions clauses will go anywhere, and Trump has said that he didn't want that to go away. And the pre-existing conditions means that everybody can get a policy whether or not they're on death's door. And, of course, that bumps right into another thing that the Republicans want to do, and that's repeal the individual mandate, because those two things are kind of linked. And if they are decoupled, it's going to make it very difficult for insurance companies to insure anybody. So I think it's that sort of thing we need to break down into what sorts of things are likely to stay, what sorts of things are likely to be negotiated, and what sorts of things are probably going to go. And if I had to make a guess right now, and we don't hear any discussion of this whatsoever, the minimum benefits that the law requires, this is a big, big problem with a lot of people out in the country. And I keep hearing from people, consumers, saying, I'm 59 years old, why do I have to buy maternity benefits? Or I have no kids, why do I have to buy a policy that includes pediatric dental care? So they don't understand about any of this cross-subsidization that's going on there. And I think the insurance industry could easily prevail on changing the minimum benefit standard with the idea that they can get rid of some of these benefits and offer cheaper policies, which would, of course, be very popular with people who are having trouble now. And the other thing I think they might want to do, or they might likely do, is change what's called the age banding. And I know this is a wonky term, but it's really important. In the law right now, insurance companies cannot charge more than three times what they, an older person, more than three times what they charge a younger person for the same coverage. And there's been a lot of talk over the years of changing that, and I wouldn't be surprised to see that go from three to five, which would mean that the older people in the pool, which could be people in their 40s, 50s, and early 60s, before they're Medicare eligible, could end up paying quite a bit more. And I wouldn't be surprised to see the Democrats go along with some of that in exchange for some other things that they want. So there's all these things that are built into it that have not been discussed and probably should be discussed, because that's what's going to happen in the 11th hour when they make their deals.
We have an email from Elizabeth in Sunnyvale, and she says, did anyone read the New York Times op-ed about health care and what Trump voters want? Someone from the Kaiser Foundation talked to Trump voters, and it sounds like what they want is single payer, although they didn't call it that.
Yeah.
And it was a really interesting op-ed. It was by Drew Altman, president of the Henry J. Kaiser Foundation, and Kaiser organized six focus groups in Grand Rapids, Michigan, New Cumberland, Pennsylvania, Columbus, Ohio, with Trump voters, and they all expressed frustration about rising premiums, deductibles, copays, drug costs. And in related news, Vox had a really good, lengthy article by Sarah Cliff. She went to Whitley County, Kentucky, and interviewed Trump voters who actually are signing people up for Obamacare. And they say that while they don't like the high costs, other problems, they really didn't believe that Donald Trump and the Republicans would repeal Obamacare. Trudy, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I have read that as well. The Trump voters that I have talked to and have sent notes to me don't say too much about single payer. Some of them do. Some of them believe that everybody ought to be in the risk pool and lament the fact that we don't have it. But I think the other thing is that they don't understand what Obamacare is. I don't think they understand, and I think this sort of comes through in some of those focus groups that Kaiser did, that they don't totally understand what the law was supposed to do. And that gets back to how it was sold, which, of course, was not very well, as I've written many times. And I think that that's what we're beginning to see here. And I think that whatever happens, I would like to see, as well as the other members of this conversation, is to have, it's a plea almost, to have a much better airing in the media of what these components are, who they benefit, who they will not benefit, and what are the alternatives to them, and what happens if they don't pass, or they don't go away, or they do go away. And I think that's what's been missing from this all along, and I would hope that Trump supporters, as well as those who didn't support Trump, would pay attention to this, because in a sense, we're all in this together.
And Will, what are your thoughts on this? One of the focus groups was in New Cumberland, Pennsylvania, and these participants didn't agree on everything, but most of them said when they heard about a new plan that might include very high deductibles, they expressed disbelief. They had no idea that this was coming.
Yeah, I did read that op-ed, and it was fascinating. And I think that I think there's a lot of roller coaster twists and turns on how this is all going to play out. Are you there?
Yes. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I'm sorry. I was having problems with my phone. I apologize. I think there's going to be a lot more twists on this roller coaster, because I think the average voter, you know, the average Trump voter and a lot of average Clinton voters haven't focused on all the ramifications of this. And there's a lot among average people, and I'm not saying this is a criticism or an indictment, but I think there's a lot of misunderstanding and misinformation over what Obamacare is. I read an anecdote just this week, and I can't verify it, but about a voter in, I think, one of the red states that has Obamacare and has a state exchange, and the person was saying, well, repealing Obamacare wouldn't affect me because I get my insurance from the state, and they didn't realize that the state exchange was Obamacare, you know. And so that might be an extreme example, but I do think I do think things are going to come out and things are going to happen about this, you know, that the average, you know, rank and file, moderately involved voter is going to be shocked at some of the consequences of either repealing Obamacare or some of the changes that they're talking about.
Hmm. Paul, what's going through your mind as you're hearing about this and what Trump voters have told Vox and the Kaiser Family Foundation?
You know, I don't know if it was from that same focus group, but I'd heard that 80% of the people that had Obamacare had told them that they were satisfied with it overall. I don't know if I've got that correct or not. You know, my main concern is that the Republicans haven't really said what they're going to replace it with. They've had 7 years to come up with a plan, and we don't see anything. And when they came out a few days ago, all they said was, we have a plan, you know, we have a plan, but we don't know what it's going to be. And what are the repercussions if Obamacare is repealed and nothing's put in its place immediately?
Trudy, this is definitely going to happen. And in fact, Paul Ryan yesterday said, as part of this plan, he also wants to gut funding for Planned Parenthood. Defunding Planned Parenthood will be part of the repeal law. Since you have spent decades covering Medicare and health care, what advice would you give reporters in the coming weeks as Republicans, you know, vow to repeal Obamacare?
Well, I think they need to do their homework. I think they need to find out themselves what's in this bill. I think they need to read I mean, there's been a lot written about it. There has been some good reporting. And I think they need to get up to snuff on exactly what is in it, what's likely to happen, and who's going to be affected by it. And I think until they can do that, it's going to be really hard for the people to find out what's going on.
And can you talk just quickly about the Planned Parenthood section of this, defunding Planned Parenthood?
No, because I haven't been following that particular part of it.
Okay, and I think, did we just lose Will? All right. Trudy, what are you working on right now?
I'm working on a piece on messaging and Obamacare, and I'll be following it very closely over the next several weeks. And then also what's going to happen to Medicare, because they've also targeted Medicare as something they want to deal with. And then also Medicaid, because Medicaid, and if it is block granted or capped in some way, lots of people will be losing coverage, and they will be some of the poorest people in this country. Mm. And I think that's something that's being lost right now in the reporting.
And what would happen to Medi-Cal coverage to those with low incomes in California if the ACA is repealed? Do you know?
Well, I assume people on Medi-Cal are getting the same kind of insurance that people in New York are getting who are on Medicaid. And I think that we have to look at the Medicaid expansion, which has been probably the most successful part of this law. I mean, it's brought coverage to more than 10 million people. And I think that that has been a real success story. And I think that has not been discussed very much in California or in New York or anywhere. And the reason for it is that nobody in the media really likes to write about Medicaid, and editors don't like to run stories about it because it's boring, it doesn't affect readers, it affects poor people, and they don't have much clout. Mm. And so I think we really have to be on top of that one.
And Paul, what are you working on right now?
Right now I'm planning to do a story on the Agent Orange problem in Vietnam. I don't think it's discussed much here in the U.S., but there are quite a few children that were born with birth defects in Vietnam as a result of the use of Agent Orange during the Vietnam War, and I'd like to go back and do a long investigative piece on how the government's dealing with it. In the U.S., veterans, we get money from the VA to cover our medical expenses if we have diabetes or some dozen other related illnesses, but in Vietnam, the people get limited support from the government.
We'd love to have you on for that. And quickly, Will, what about you? What are you working on?
It's all Trump transition all the time. You know, one story that fascinates me, and we're going to see this play out the inaugural weekend in Washington, is really a political uprising among women in particular who haven't been politically active. It is kind of skewed towards suburbs and more affluent areas, but an uprising of women voters who are just offended by the Trump presidency. And yeah, I think that's going to be a big story in 2017.
Yeah, I'm glad you're covering that. A lot of the women who were behind that march have never been involved in politics before. Will Bunch. Yeah, thank you. Will Bunch is an award-winning veteran political journalist, senior writer with the Philadelphia Daily News. Paul Mooney is an award-winning freelance journalist. And Trudy Lieberman is a longtime healthcare reporter, contributing editor to the Columbia Journalism Review. Will, Paul, and Trudy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And coming up on Monday's Your Call, what is the future of the Democratic Party? We'll have a conversation about how the party is moving forward after millions of working people decided to vote for Trump. Democrats also lost crucial, crucial seats across the country. So what have they learned from these defeats? That's on Monday. Your Call is produced here at KALW. Malihe Razazan produced today's show. Helena Murphy is our researcher. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. You can email us feedback at yourcallradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Thanks for joining us.